Welcome to Socialist Voices. We have an incredible podcast today. I say that in all honesty. The contributions this time are brilliant. We have SSP co-spokespeople Sandra Webster and Colin Fox, Sandra on Paisley's smash shot, and Colin on the SNP's strange relationship with the monarchy. We have Don McKean on racism in the USA, the Confederate flag, and of course the awful terrorist events in Charleston last week. We have Dr. Bruce Scott speaking about mental distress from a socialist perspective. We have blogger and transgender woman Amber Daniels on her experiences. Matthew Geraghty on our democratic deficit. Australian Socialist Alliance member Dave Riley on The Lucky Country. SNP activist Deborah Torrance with a very emotional plea about the terrible events in the Mediterranean. Callum Martin on the SSP alternative to the council tax, the much fairer Scottish service tax. And this is Aidan O'Rourke with a suggestion for the SSP.
Hiya, I'm Aidan O'Rourke from the Ayrshire branch of the Scottish Socialist Party, and I want to tell you a wee story. Now, during a discussion that I've had with a potential new comrade at one of my recent SSP branch meetings, they made the wonderful point about how we package ourselves and how we present ourselves as a party. Now, if you consider the Scottish National Party, how often do you see the SNP being referred to as the Scottish National Party? Occasionally, aye, but if you're to examine the majority of their correspondence and their propaganda, then you'd see that in most instances, they abbreviate the name of the party down to SNP. In the promotional material, if it's on their leaflets, their posters, or most importantly, on their logos, the information and the graphics on display are simple, clear, and straight to the point. I'm sure most of you are aware by now that the SNP have recently enjoyed tremendous electoral success. Now, while it would be ridiculous to suggest that this success is entirely down to how they market themselves, it's still important that we in the SSP look to the SNP as a possible template for our own marketing. Now, one of the first examples that we should try to emulate is that we should refer to ourselves as much as possible as the SSP instead of as the Scottish Socialist Party. And the SNP are undoubtedly a nationalist party. Despite this, they're comprised of members of all shapes and sizes, including all sorts of political beliefs, whether socialist, nationalist, social democrat, or anything else in between. Now, that's not by chance, although it's true that the SNP are widely seen as the major vehicle to independence in Scotland. It wouldn't be a stretch to suggest that the glossing over of the word national allows the SNP to appeal to a much wider and larger audience. It's exactly this that the SSP have to try and do. Whether we like it or not, most people which we'll encounter will, for whatever reason, have no time, no interest to talk socialism. By referring to ourselves as much as possible as the SSP, it distances us from that idea of socialism without necessarily watering down the message which we preach. It gives us room, gives us more room to manoeuvre and to attract more members and voters. Now, when I was thinking about this, the first kind of example I thought of was that our logo shouldn't be the Scottish Socialist Party in full bold text across a background. It should instead be something simple and easily digestible. It should be something like the SSP in red with a red star with a yellow background, or the opposite, it should be a yellow SSP with a yellow star and a red background. I think this is because if we keep it simple, then it's going to have far more of an impact on the uninitiated. In most cases, when the general public see a stall or they look at a leaflet, there's a very minute window in which the message that we're portraying is going to be absorbed. Now, as I said, in such a scenario, less is more. It's absolutely vital that as a party, we reassess the way in which we package ourselves and how we package our message. This new comrade that I mentioned earlier essentially described the approach of one of our comrades, the co-spokesperson Sandra Webster. Now, she described it without actually having met her. And by that I mean that when you strip back the socialist message, it all boils down to one simple fact, that our message is that you need to care for everyone in your society, especially those such as the working class and any other individual or member of society who is being oppressed, especially by the recent Tory cuts and austerity. As a party and as socialists, we care just as much, if not more so, as any other decent thinking human being for the rights and the common weal of everybody in our society. The comradely and welcoming nature of both our meetings and our street stalls are but one small example of that overpowering sense of loyalty and duty to our local communities. There's no loss of face involved in repackaging the way in which we present our socialist message. But however, by simplifying the way in which we present ourselves as a party, and by refraining from falling into the trap of being portrayed as aggressive, mindless, shouty socialists, we can make it so much easier for ourselves to connect with our audience, who will be more receptive to our message once the jargon interfering with this message is toned down a bit. It's clear that there needs to be an overhaul on how we present ourselves to the public. It's still the case that when choosing a Left party in Scotland, most people would probably opt for the Greens over ourselves, and they would do this because the Greens are seen as not being quite as aggressive, confrontational, or being depicted as subversive radicals, but they're seen as being nice and friendly, engaging people. And a lot of the time, that's what people want. That's what they want in politics. Now, as unfortunate as it might be, as a socialist party, we're still seen in many circles as radicals, as aggressive subversives. And the truth is that we really are just as nice, friendly and engaging as our comrades in the Greens, more or less. But while we may be depicted as being more radical or aggressive, we're only seen as such because our passion for the rights and liberation of every oppressed and exploited individual in our society is without measure. Now, we wear our hearts and our principles on our sleeves, and we're rightly proud of it. But all of us must understand that we can educate people on socialism and its merits without labouring the point and without actually having to directly talk about socialism. That's not opportunism, in my opinion. I think that's common sense. I think that message is really going to reach people far greater than the word socialism would. The first mention of the word socialism turns most people off, from my experience. And this is despite the fact that socialism would almost certainly benefit them if they had not had the perception of what it is and what it means to them tainted by the way they're brought up, by the capitalist education system, by the mass media, the likes of Rupert Murdoch, who obviously oppose socialism just out of habit. Now, what I propose is that first of all, we adopt graphics such as the one I described earlier. Simple graphics, lettering just saying SSP with a star and a simple background. I want us to refrain from the use of the term the Scottish Socialist Party as much as we possibly can in our official correspondence and propaganda. That's not to say that we shouldn't ever call ourselves the Scottish Socialist Party, I'm just saying we should try and avoid it if possible. Thirdly, I think that we should instead refer to ourselves as the SSP as much as possible in every opportunity, as I've said before. I think that we should be keeping our socialist message simple, and by expressing it in terms in which the vast majority of the public can understand and relate to, we'll find that we'll probably be far more successful in getting our message through to people. And fifthly, I think that we should be avoiding the use of aggressive, harsh language and socialist terminology when the situation doesn't require it, as it can be off-putting to potential new members, particularly to women and people new to politics. Now, those are just some of my ideas on the subject, and I'm very keen for there to be a wide-ranging discussion on the matter. I think it's important that everyone in the party has their say. It's a very important issue, and I think it could do us all the good. It would get us away from the previous kind of stigmatisms that are associated with the party, and it would give us that chance to kind of breathe some fresh new air into the party to try and match that same fresh new air that the recent influx of especially younger new members has brought to the party. So that's pretty much all I want to say. Thanks for listening.
These are the Hurriers, and this is Big Ideas and Promises.
To be the ups and downs of living life and a My name's Ian Bartholomew, and I'm the host of Apolitical. We're a short weekly podcast with interviews of Scottish politicians and others involved in Scottish politics. Our guest on episode 10 was Colin Fox, who will be well known to listeners of this show. You can download the podcast from apoliticalpodcast.com or iTunes right now. And once you've listened to Colin, please feel free to catch up on the rest of the interviews. That was apoliticalpodcast.com, and you can also find us on Twitter at apoliticalpod. Cheers.
The nervous relationship between the SNP and the monarchy surfaced again this week when Sir Alan Reid, the keeper of the Privy Purse, yes, that's his right title, he happens to be the Queen's chief executive, or the chief executive of the Queen PLC. He gave evidence to a select committee at Westminster, voicing his nervousness, his concern about the decision to devolve income from the Scottish Crown Estates to Holyrood next year, fearing, he said, that the Scottish National Party at Holyrood might hold back some of the royal family's state benefits. And his remarks were seized upon by the right-wing press in London, who alleged that this was the start of some sinister Republican insurrection by the SNP, unquote. And we then had the spectacle of First Minister Nicola Sturgeon hurrying nervously into the fray to stamp on the idea, to make it clear the SNP is not Republican. This story has no basis in fact, she said. By hook or by crook, she said, Scotland will pay their contribution to the sovereign grant in full and on time. And following the First Minister's intervention, Sir Alan is apparently no longer worried. Move on. There's nothing to see here, insisted SNP chief strategist and policeman Stephen Noon on Twitter. But hold on a minute. There seems to be a great deal of tension in the SNP about this non-story. Could it be that they don't want to talk about the monarchy, lest people believe that they're in favour of a modern democratic republic for Scotland? Because, of course, they're not. And the SNP's nervousness touches on the fact that the SNP are increasingly keen to prove to the British political establishment that the Queen is safe in their hands. But at the same time, Buckingham Palace is clearly unsettled by the mood of the SNP's working class voters, who are much more sympathetic to a republic where a political head of state is elected, accountable and representative of the people here. None of which, of course, the monarchy can ever achieve. And this is a story which simply refuses to go away for the SNP for one very good reason. The Scottish National Party is attempting to face both ways at once on this issue. They're trying to placate a conservative rural electorate, principally in the northeast of Scotland heartland, who want to keep the Queen as the head of state in an independent Scotland. And of course, they're under increasing pressure from the 100,000 principally working class members who've joined the SNP in the Central Belt, who are much more attracted to the idea of a modern democratic republic. This is, quite frankly, a story that refuses to go away. And the best wishes of Nicola Sturgeon, Alex Salmond, or Stephen Noon, for that matter, will come to nothing. And it seems an important time to point out that the Scottish Socialist Party's pamphlet for a modern democratic republic is now free to download on the Scottish Socialist Party's website. Enjoy.
From Stereogram Records, this is The Cathode Ray and Buck the Trend.
Trends. Deborah Torrens. I'm an SNP member here at the branch in Mogai. I wanted to talk to you today about some things I've seen on the internet. Now, I know the internet is not a pretty place, but these videos really spoke to me. They actually hurt me. They're heartbreaking. They were posted by the UN Refugee Agency, and they are accompanied by a couple of quotes. One of them were, "We were scared. It was windy in the sea and the boat's motor stopped working." It then goes on to tell you about the children and a baby were among a group of 44 refugees and migrants rescued from an overloaded dinghy struggling to float in the high seas off of Lesbos in Greece. Greek coast guards, who are currently rescuing up to three boats a night, moved swiftly to save the exhausted group of mainly Syrians and Afghans from a failing boat meant to carry just 25 people. Bassam from Syria told them, "We didn't choose to be refugees, but our life in danger, especially with my young boy, I love him so much. When I decided to bring him, risk his life, is because there was a strong reason to do that. I wouldn't have left our country if me and my family weren't at risk of being killed any day." And you watch the video and it's a big ship sailing through the ocean, lifeguards shining a torch, and then in the pitch black there is a reflection of folks' heads and they're all crammed into this dinghy. It is, my brother has a dinghy like it and there's five of us been on it and we've been a bit squashed. It wasn't much bigger than that. There are people sitting the whole way around the outside of this dinghy, and then there were four and five deep, and in the middle there were children, and the lifeguards are shouting, don't panic, stay seated, we're coming, grab the ropes, tie us off, and they're pulling the boat in, and the first thing you see is a wee baby about one and a half getting carried across the deck, and his father scrambles after him, and the father's so relieved to be in this Coast Guard boat, and his wee baby's sitting on his knee and he's wearing a floaty jacket like the ones you see wee kids at the swimming with, and there are other kids there, they're maybe about seven, another wee toddler, and they're wearing a wee bit better, instead of a inflatable one, they're wearing like those fabric ones you get if you go kayaking or something. These aren't for going across a sea that's got heavy traffic in it, with big massive tankers and ferries. And these people were on a bloody boat, a boat that you would rent by Loch Lomond or something. You wouldn't go into Strathclyde Park in the dark in this boat. Never mind try and cross a sea. What are these folk fleeing from? And then the other video I saw was at Calais, and how all the ferries have been stopped and there's strikes happening, and all the refugees are taking advantage of this and trying to get across, clambering through the the Channel Tunnel. And I'm thinking, oh my God, if I saw one of these waywains, I would let them in the car. And the news is saying, if you are a UK tourist returning home, please make sure your car's windows are locked and your doors are locked. It's like, no, we need to help these people. They're going to be dying in a boat in the pitch black in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. I can't believe that I'm part of this country, the United Kingdom, who armed the rebels in Syria. And, you know, what is happening? Are we contributing to these folks suffering? Of course we are. UK is the 7th in the world biggest arms dealer. Think about that for a minute. 7th in the world biggest arms dealer. Who's buying all the arms? It's breaking my heart. Every time I see the video, I cry, because that wee child could be one of my great nieces or nephews. Could be one of yours. Could be your child. I just hope that we can do something to help these folk.
Thief Action are playing the left field stage at Glastonbury this year. Over to you, Chris Babyface Fox.
Hi, from Glastonbury, where Billy Bragg has invited Thief Action to play on his left field stage. Looking forward to a fantastic weekend, playing with staunch comrades like Grace Petrie and Attila the Stockbroker, and hopefully hooking up with people like Mark Sawatka, Charlotte Church and others. So if any of you are here at Glastonbury, get down to left field for 6 o'clock on Saturday evening. Then race over to see Mavis Staples, if I were you, as soon as Thief Action are finished. We see Jeremy Corbyn suggested that private tenants should have the right to buy, just like council tenants. It's a nice idea. But we think there's too much emphasis on ownership. Let's slash and control rents instead. It's not going to happen unless we agitate for it. We need a rent strike. We'll play this one at Glastonbury on Saturday night, but if you're not going to be there, here it is for you now. Thanks.
Paper, tax, a guy. Anyone who knew me growing up would assume I had a good childhood. And in many respects, I did. My parents were loving, I never fell victim to the callous hardships of child poverty, and domestic abuse was nothing more than a horror story I'd never witnessed firsthand. I was a lucky kid in most respects, except for one. At the age of 6, I began to develop a series of rather distressing thoughts. From the day of my birth, I'd been raised a boy named Daniel. My parents, classmates and teachers all reinforced this fact by addressing me as such. Except not long after my 6th birthday, a thought popped into my head, one which simply refused to leave. This thought told me that I was not a boy, but in fact, a girl. Nonsense, I told myself. I'm not a girl. I mean, if I was, Mum and Dad would have surely told me by now. Plus, if I was one, I wouldn't be called Daniel. Surely I'd have a name like Sophie, or Jessica, or even Danielle. As the years went on, this thought kept popping up, time after time, badgering me at the most inconvenient of hours. I'm a girl, I'm a girl, I'm a girl, I kept thinking. The notion continued springing up like a faulty jack-in-the-box that refused to stay shut. Every time I heard such words, a momentary burst of intense sadness twanged in the pit of my stomach, making me feel as though everything about my life was wrong and twisted and upside down. Seeing as I'd been raised to behave like a boy, and seeing as the other boys didn't seem to think about being little girls, I decided to try and ignore such sadness so I could get on with my life. The ignorance game worked for a little while, but then I started having dreams in which a future version of myself travelled back in time to tell me all about my future. Apparently, I had a job as a teacher, 2 beautiful children, and a house all of my own. The most dramatic difference about the me of tomorrow, however, was that I had grown up to become a woman. By the time puberty came along, the inner voice grew louder than ever before, and more frequent for that matter. I'm a girl, I'm a girl, I'm a girl, over and over again, like a faulty record. Furthermore, the twang of sadness was now even more potent than it had ever been. As hair began sprouting from random parts of my face, and my voice started transforming into something hideous, the discomfort morphed into a far more unpleasant beast. Still, the only thing I felt I could do at this point was continue to ignore it, in the hope that sooner or later it would vanish. Day after day, year after year, the pain associated with that one thought evolved into a monster intent on ripping my life to shreds. Eventually, I discovered that what I suffered from was gender dysphoria, the condition of feeling one's emotional and psychological gender identity to be opposite to one's biological sex. That is the definition, at least. By the age of 22, I'd had enough. I started gradually at this point coming out to friends and family, telling them that I was transgender. It was around this time that I also began experimenting with my gender expression on a visual level. I'd buy clothes from the women's sections of stores, teach myself how to apply makeup, practice speaking in a higher tone of voice, and exercise the art of walking more like that of a woman. By 23, I found myself paying hefty sums of money for electrolysis in a bid to permanently remove my facial hair. Finally, by the time January 2015 came about, I found myself living almost full-time as a woman. I had yet to change my name via deed poll and begin hormone replacement therapy. However, socially, I was presenting and identifying as Amber. 6 months later, and here I am. I still work as a boy, a fact which should hopefully not remain for much longer. However, when it comes to all other aspects of one's life, I live and exist among society in a gender opposing the one I was assigned at birth. Seeing as I'm not yet on a female hormone regime, it is quite obvious to the rest of society that I was born biologically male. It's clear to most that I am indeed a trans woman. I don't, as many trans people often like to call it, pass as a cisgender woman. For those who may be wondering, cisgender is a term which applies to any individual who identifies with the gender they were assigned at birth. So if a baby male grows up and is comfortable living as a man, then he's cis. It essentially means non-transgender person. But anyhow, I digress. Although many are growing more and more tolerant of gender-variant individuals these days, large portions of society still seem to have something of an issue when it comes to transgender people. We are raised in a world which tells us that there are boys and girls and nothing in between. Those born with penises are part of the guy gang, whereas those with vaginas are members of the girl group. These are the rules we are taught as children, and many grow up perfectly content with this understanding of gender. When those of us who elect to challenge these conventions, however, people begin to grow uncomfortable. We are a society obsessed with gender norms, and anything beyond those norms is often seen as unusual, frightening, and in some cases, dangerous. I knew this before coming out, of course. Even as early as the days when I first started having these notions of knowing I was really a girl inside, people around me made numerous unsavoury remarks toward any so-called men who decided to dress or behave as women. Comedians on the telly would crack jokes about so-called blokes in dresses. Teachers would tell boys off for putting on girls' clothes during games of dress-up. And even my own family would often accuse the local transsexual of only changing her sex simply because a former drug addiction scrambled her brain into doing so. As I got older, acquaintances and classmates would talk about how transsexuals were freaks and perverts who deserved to be locked away. Even when I reached university, I'd often hear people talk about how repulsed they were by a trans student who was attending the same class as them. Humour and insulting remarks were made whenever the subject of transgender identities popped up. The terms weirdo, freak, pervert, and sicko were all too frequent among such discussions. The basic lesson I learned from this? People clearly have a problem with people like me. Since deciding to openly live as a trans woman, I've begun to see some of this distaste played out from the other side. Now I am the so-called freak in the eyes of a stranger. No one has said this to my face as of yet. However, the random bursts of laughter that I sometimes hear, plus the gawping stares of gosh knows how many strangers, remind me that I am no longer just a face in the crowd. Sometimes I can get away with it. If I'm in a busy gathering or a darkened room, I become just another face again. When I venture to my local supermarket or coffee shop, on the other hand, then it can often feel as though the spotlight is turned upon me. Random folk will do double takes in my direction. Spontaneous bursts of laughter erupt as fellow citizens hear me speak, and gangs of teenage girls whisper to one another as they stare my way. This doesn't happen all the time, of course. However, it's certainly started to become a familiar part of my day-to-day life. It's as though I've suddenly become semi-famous, and passers-by are trying to figure out where on earth they've seen me before. The laughing doesn't just happen with folk in the street. I've also had shopkeepers and bartenders sometimes chuckle when they've come face-to-face with me. Yet when it comes to people serving me, the minuscule giggle spurts are not the biggest of my problems. Instead, what really seems to be the issue is staff members' frequent habits of misgendering me. Misgendering is a difficult one to explain to many people, largely because most never know what it really feels like. When you grow up as one sex, yet identify as a gender not assigned to you, one experiences something known as gender dysphoria. It's somewhat difficult to describe what gender dysphoria feels like. However, the best way I can explain it is liking it to a seeing a photograph of something which makes you incredibly distressed. Say, for example, you can't stand the sight of surgeons performing operations, or bones being snapped in two. That light-headed feeling associated with such images is very similar to the feeling I experience when I catch a glance of myself in the mirror, feel the prickles of my facial hair as I scratch my neck, am made to wear a suit to formal events, am forced to use the men's bathroom, or am referred to in masculine pronouns by another. Most of the time, whenever a taxi driver, shopkeeper, or bartender calls me sir, I'm sure they aren't doing it with malicious intent. Many people still have blind spots when it comes to the subject of transgender identities and don't really know what language to use around them, meaning that they don't realise that by referring to trans men and women by using pronouns based on their birth assigned gender can cause severe emotional distress. We live in a society which tells us from a very young age that male equals man and female equals woman. Even though gender identity and sex are not one of the same thing, we are all raised to believe that they are. But then there are those who do intentionally refer to me as Mr. or Sir on purpose. often adding extra emphasis on the pronouns as they say them. These people are the ones who often refuse to accept trans folk for their preferred gender identity and expression because of their belief that genitals and chromosomes dictate how another should identify or be identified. Although gender references social and cultural differences rather than biological, such people believe that the shape of an organ between my legs and the type of DNA hiding within my cells have the final say on the matter. And this is a belief which still seems quite common, even in 2015. Both friends and even myself have found ourselves in discussions with others who have claimed that transgender women are not really women and transgender men are not really men, simply because of their DNA and genitalia. Even though many can be born with one set of genitals whilst their chromosomes fail to match up, and even though many can lose parts of their reproductive organs through illness or operations, or even accidents, such people still refuse to perceive gender any differently. I'm not sure why some cisgender people hold on to this belief with such stubbornness. Maybe it's so they can use sex to validate their own gender insecurities. So if they don't think that they're feminine or masculine enough, then they can just say their chromosomes prove that they are. Either way, it appears to be a common belief still held amongst many. The refusal to believe trans men and women have the right to identify as their preferred gender doesn't just serve to hurt feelings and trigger dysphoria-related distress, however. It also has the power to restrict gender-variant people, such as myself, from privileges that many cisgender folk take for granted. For example, most believe that if I use the women's toilets or changing rooms, then I'm venturing into an area where I simply do not belong. Never mind that using the men's changing facilities would cause me humiliation, emotional discomfort, and a refusal to live as the woman I identify as. Such people are of the opinion that because I was born male, my presence in women-only facilities is somehow a danger to their safety. The common fear is that because of my biological sex, I could sexually assault or spy on the other women using those facilities. Even though there's never been a reported case of gender-variant people sexually or physically assaulting cisgender individuals in public restrooms or changing facilities, the myth continues to live on. The sad irony of this fact is that many transgender men and women have been assaulted and screamed away from gender-assigned areas as a result of this transphobic paranoia. So far, I've not experienced any verbal or physical aggression at the hands of another. However, I've known plenty of transgender men and women who have done. Furthermore, I've received numerous tuts and headshakes from disapproving women who cross paths with me in restrooms. Hearing such horror stories and witnessing such looks of disapproval have made going to the bathroom in a public space a terrifying and humiliating ordeal for me these days. Needing to pee at a service station toilet will never be the same for me again. To many, of course, all these words are nothing more than a load of nonsense. I hear that word bandied about quite often in reference to trans-related issues. Taxpayers shouldn't be funding this nonsense, a caller will shout when discussing the topic of gender reassignment surgery on a daily debate programme. Being asked to call people by their preferred pronouns is a load of politically correct nonsense, types an annoyed poster on an internet forum. Why are you still reporting this nonsense, complains a reader fed up with hearing about Caitlyn Jenner in their preferred choice of tabloid. Yes, nonsense is a word I've heard all too often in reference to trans people. Our identities are seen by many as nothing more than a convoluted load of hogwash. And although I disagree with such incredulity, of course, I can kind of get why some may think in such a manner. I mean, if someone has never experienced the pains of having a gender identity opposing one's physical sex, then of course it's going to be hard for them to empathise. Most people go their entire lives never once questioning their identities on this kind of level. They are happy with how they were raised and simply cannot imagine the thought of ever living their life as the opposite. To cisgender people, altering body shape via the use of hormone therapy, changing entire names by deed poll, dressing in clothes opposing their birth gender, and having their genitals operated on so they resemble that of the opposite sexes are unimaginable notions. To simply write off transgender people as deluded fantasists, however, is hugely problematic. It ignores the distress individuals such as myself have to grow up with, the shame we are psychologically programmed to feel toward ourselves, the abuse we receive at the hands of others, and the discrimination we endure as a result of transgressing society's ideas of what makes men men and women women. Despite the problems which come with being trans, however, it would appear that things are now slowly moving in the right direction for us. Trans visibility is gradually becoming more and more common in today's society, and people's hostility is steadily subsiding. From the most recent Louis Theroux documentary about transgender children, to the Caitlyn Jenner media explosion, to the appearance of Laverne Cox on Time magazine's cover, the world is starting to take notice of trans individuals, and their responses are far more positive than they were 10 or 20 years ago. Prejudice may still be a common occurrence in the lives of many transgender folk. However, let us hope that from here onward, understanding and acceptance can gradually begin to override the cruelties of yesterday.
1, 2, 3, 4. First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you, they're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change. So quick. The congressmen and businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times, the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you, how it can spread out like a net, and everything can change. So quick. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change. So quick. Everything can change. So quick.
Time of year again. There are gala days the length and breadth of Scotland. In fact, of all these isles, days which are workers' holidays. We might just think of them of days when the bairns can eat lots of candy floss and go on spinny rides and feel sick. But they're all part of our working class heritage. The thread of our history weaves its way through to the present. Paisley, my adopted town, has its own special day, held on the first Saturday in July. It is a celebration of workers' struggles in Paisley. The snapshot was an invisible thread that held together all the threads that made up the fabric of shawls, the famous Paisley pattern. However, this was unseen. The bosses, known locally as Corks, refused to pay for it. There was a long dispute. The Charleston drum was beaten through the streets of Paisley, calling the weavers to protest at last. And at last they won. And in 1865, it became Smashot Day, the first Saturday in July. The drum was beaten again to summon the workers to their annual holiday. The drum still beats today, leading a procession of workers from Brodie Park to Abbey Close. An effigy of the boss, or Cork, as they were called locally, is carried. Workers and unions march, all different people. Charming people call for the Cork to be burned without fear of arrest. Yes, Paisley should be twinned with the St Miles. It is a great day and a proud tradition. The highlight of the day, the Cork exploded in a bloom of fireworks and we all applaud. Come and join us this year and march to the beat of the Charleston drum. For more information, one of Renfrewshire SSP members, Andy Gibbon, has written a brilliant pamphlet about the full history. Remember, wherever you go this summer, whatever gala day, past struggles do in time become celebrations.
The previous track was David Rovick's and Everything Can Change. These are the Cundies and this is Just a Number. Scott recently spoke at the SSP AGM. What he said was inspirational. I asked him onto the podcast to speak on his views on mental health and socialism.
My name is Dr. Bruce Scott, and this podcast is entitled Mental Distress from a Socialist Perspective. It is laudable that mental health campaigns show concern for the mental health of our citizens. However, I have serious reservations with the concept of mental health, which are routinely overlooked. I prefer to say mental distress. This is my reasoning. First, the discourse of mental health or mental illness is not all it is cracked up to be. In other words, the biological model of mental health is a highly dubious concept. The evidence of organic substrates attributed to the cause of mental illness is nowhere near to that of physical illness. In fact, they are incomparable from a scientific point of view. For example, you cannot test for a biochemical imbalance in the brain for a diagnosis of depression, anxiety, or schizophrenia. In essence, the jury is out on all organic markers of so-called mental illness, and according to many experts, the jury will be out indefinitely. Second, the cognitive imperialistic discourse of mental health, in other words, cognitive behavioural therapy, is misleading and excludes other discourses of conceptualising mental distress. There are thousands of years of philosophy and numerous other alternative psychotherapeutic and psychoanalytic practices which deal with mental distress in rather different ways, which are very effective, but are hardly amenable to the so-called rigorous nature of our current cultural popularisation of evidence-based medicine. Certain tools or discourses, which many in the medical and psychological profession use, such like the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, destroy other ways of conceptualising meaning-making regarding our mental distress. The symbolic, or the language one uses, of the DSM discourse is regarded as cast iron. Words or diagnoses are taken as entities, these entities are taken as facts, and as a result of the proliferation of DSM diagnoses in the media, like depression and anxiety, the DSM discourse becomes solidified into the language of the masses. However, such a covering over and domination of one's language prevents one from contributing to the meaning-making of the world. What the medical imperialists of mental distress cannot accept is that there may be many meanings, or even that there is no final meaning. Why, for some, is this such a terror? Is it such a terror? For many, it is a terror. We live in a society where risk prevention is paramount, where avenues of alternative thought and searching for alternative meaning in life are outlawed or hidden, and where the questioning and traversing of ideological borders are taboo and not taught in any of our state educational contexts. For example, where in mainstream culture is it taught how to question and critique the psychological and psychiatric masters' ideas about the psychological and neurochemical basis of mental illness? We are in a situation where we are alienated from our own subjectivities, our creativity, our distress, and meaning-making of the world. Karl Marx alluded to this situation of alienation. Alienation has occurred in work or labour in the 21st century, for example, in McJobs, call centre factories, job performance scrutinised and tied to wages, unpaid internships and zero-hours contracts. Alienation is also very present in the productivity of our subjectivities. We automatically think things like, we have depression, we have OCD, or we have ADHD, etc. Our products or our productions of our psyches are limited within narrow confines. In other words, we produce or are coerced to produce subjectivities in relation to the dominant cognitive and neurobiological imperialistic discourse of mental illness. As the authors of Capitalism and Schizophrenia, Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, would argue, we have been territorialised by the machines of capitalist discourse to only produce subjectivities which place mental distress within an individual context. The individual is to blame. One's faulty cognitions or neurochemistry is to blame, and we need experts to fix this. After all, the state needs workers who blame themselves and put themselves at the mercy of the psycho-experts to rehabilitate them, but never to question the existing dominant socio-economic ideology. Yes, austerity causes distress, but please do not call it exacerbating existing mental illness. That is not the whole story, an accurate story or a fair story. It is more like a fairy story. So, while I wholly understand the need and the desire to campaign for those in mental distress, we have to be very careful what we demand. Jacques Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, who had quite a few things to say about the ravages of capitalism, warned about asking the governmental masters for change. He said, "Beware what you ask for, because all you will get is a new master." Here is a harsh lesson in light of the glut of campaigning for mental health that occurs today. We have a long way to go for those of us, all of us, in mental distress, to subvert the master-slave dialectic of the cognitive, neuroscientific, imperialistic, and alienating discourse of mental illness. Mental illness is holed up in all the nooks and crannies of the establishment. Universities, psychiatry, psychology, pharmaceutical companies, and also in certain psychotherapeutic fashions like mindfulness and other so-called panaceas who all want a piece of capital pie. Mental distress is far more than an alert to an illness to be cured by a pharmaceutical straitjacket, i.e. drugs, or a program of thought control, i.e. cognitive behavioral therapy. This brave new world is not threatening to come. It is already here in the guise of Tory mental health policy. In a recent article by Felicity Callard and Robert Stern in the British Medical Journal, psychological coercion and manipulation has become a daily part of life for people claiming benefits. Curing unemployment has become a growth market for psychologists. Job centres are becoming medical centres. Claimants are becoming patients. Psychological practitioners are state enforcers, and unemployment is now regarded as a psychological disorder. Fictional illnesses such as psychological resistance to work and entrenched worklessness are mentioned in ministerial speeches and lucrative Department for Work and Pensions contracts, with, as yet, little protest from professional psychologists and therapists and their associated organisations. Psychological explanations for unemployment highlight the feelings of the maladjusted job seeker. This isolates, blames and stigmatises people on benefits under the cosh of a totalitarian and alienating capitalist regime. People are now forced to engage in psychological treatment and workfare schemes, which means, except you have a psychological deficit and work for nothing. Refuse such prescriptions and one faces losing one's benefits. Such social engineering obscures the realities of the labour market and the political choices that underpin it. We would be wise to lend an ear to the wisdom of Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous French philosopher, in these turbulent and austere times of mental health campaigning. Comrades, turn your illness into a weapon.
The Wakes recently played a fundraiser for the SSP and were on the End Austerity Now stage last week in Glasgow. They mentioned the Bethlehem to Belfast campaign. They and David Rovics have recorded an EP to help with the campaign. All funds from the downloads will go towards bringing some young Palestinians from two Bethlehem refugee camps over to Belfast for this year's Anti-Racism World Cup. Please buy the EP. I'll add the link to the sspcampsy.podbean.com website or our podcast archive, and give what you can for this great cause. These are the Wakes and the David Rovics song, They're Building a Wall.
They're building a wall, a wall between friends, a wall that justifies any means for their ends, a wall between Semites, rich and poor, brothers and sisters from not so long before. Many feet thick and 20 feet high, no one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide. Now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between water and land, so we can eat fruit and they can eat sand. A wall to make sure that our orchards will grow and our kids can get fat and not need to know of the cities in ruins and the children in fear that your fathers and brothers in tanks might be near. A wall to keep quiet that in which you fear most, so you don't have to listen
see your grandfather's ghost. They're building a wall between your future and past, a wall to keep separate the chambers of gas from bulldozers, gunships, and the tears of a child. And dignity alone in all of her defiles. So remove reality from your facts on the ground. A wall to keep distance that terrible sounds of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie. They're building a wall, and at such a cost. Land, money and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken.
On 17th July, 21-year-old Dylan Roof went into the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and took part in a Bible study. After an hour, he opened fire, saying, "You rape our women and you have to go, and I'll give you something to pray about." When he was done, nine people were dead, including Clementa Pinckney, the pastor and a state senator, and 87-year-old choir member Susie Jackson. In the immediate aftermath of the shooting, the media suggested that the shooter may have had mental health problems and described him as a quiet, shy loner who kept to himself. And one Fox News pundit stated that the problem was that liberals tolerate transgender people. And then a Twitter user, Henry Crinkle, did something journalists could have done and used a website that allowed him to see if Roof had any websites. Using a reverse Whois search, he found that there was a website assigned to one Dylan Roof, and he asked other Twitter users if they could stump up the $49 needed to reveal the site. Emma Quangle offered to pay, saying that, "As a communist, it is my duty and obligation to spend at least $49 to help ruin this guy's insanity plea." And so, thanks to two Twitter users, we found that Roof had written a manifesto on his website, lastrhodesian.com. On it, he writes that the Trayvon Martin case awakened him, as he felt George Zimmerman was right and he couldn't see what the big deal was. He then Googled black-on-white crime, and this led him to the website of the Council for Conservative Citizens, an organization that grew out of the White Citizens Council of the 50s and 60s and had opposed the civil rights movement. The Council of Conservative Citizens states on its website that it opposes all efforts to mix the races of mankind. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors right-wing groups and racist groups, considers the council as part of a neo-Confederate movement. Roof's manifesto is a hate-filled rant against black people, Jews, and Hispanics. On the site, he's also pictured burning an American flag, pointing a pistol, and in several, he is holding a Confederate flag. And so it has become more difficult to dismiss this as a case of someone with a mental health problem, as the media usually does when the shooter is white. In 2012, a white supremacist, Wade Michael Page, killed 6 people at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, and the media was full of stories about his possible mental health problems. The reality is that, as with Roof, he was a white nationalist terrorist. The USA has always had a serious problem with this sort of terrorism. After the Civil War, 6 Scots Presbyterians formed the Ku Klux Klan to terrorize newly freed blacks. Thousands of black people were murdered in the years following the war, and this continued into the Civil Rights period. Today, there are numerous white nationalist groups in the USA and Europe, and while they don't all agree with one another, many have taken to use the Confederate flag as their symbol. Not only does it represent the racist regime of the slave South, but in many European nations, while it's illegal to go around with a swastika, it's perfectly legal to go around with a Confederate flag. After the coup in Ukraine, the Confederate flag was raised in Kiev City Hall, along with a Celtic cross, the logo of the white nationalist website Stormfront. After Roof's manifesto appeared and made the usual dismissal of his terrorism more difficult, many people called for the Confederate flag to be removed from the South Carolina State House. Governor Nikki Haley said that after 150 years, it was time for the flag to come down. But in reality, the flag has only flown there since 1961, and the reasons for that are worth knowing. In 1961, there was a centennial celebration for the day South Carolina opened fire on Fort Sumter, the first shot of the Civil War. The Confederate flag was hoisted above the State House. 2 Northern delegations to the centennial were refused entry to the ceremony as they had black members, including Madeline Williams, the first black woman elected to the New Jersey state legislature. President Kennedy intervened and moved the commemoration to the Charleston Naval Base. Truman had desegregated the military with Executive Order 9981 in 1948, so the naval base was able to accommodate an integrated crowd. By the way, it was after Truman had passed Executive Order 9981, as well as anti-lynching laws, that the Confederate flag regained its popularity as a symbol in the South. Dylann Roof knew what he was doing. He understood the symbolism of the Confederate flag and the racist history it stands for. He knew that the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church was not only an important symbol of the civil rights movement, but was founded by Denmark Vesey, who planned a failed slave revolt inspired by the Haitian Revolution. Vesey was executed in 1822, and the original church was burned down by white supremacists. Taking down the Confederate flag is an important step forward. Making meaningful progress in gun control, as Obama has called for, is also important. But it is far more important that Americans, and those of us in the orbit of the American empire, acknowledge, understand, and denounce white supremacy. According to the New America Foundation, since 9/11, twice as many Americans have died at the hands of white supremacists or anti-government groups than Muslim terrorists. But no one is calling for the white community to root out the extremists among them, and that is because this white terrorism is dismissed, excused as mental illness, or ignored. The Council of Conservative Citizens, for its part, has said that while it condemns Dylann Roof's terrorism, the shootings do not detract in the slightest from the legitimacy of some of the positions he has expressed.
This is Roy Moller on Another Man's God.
She put her money in another man's bank account. That other man is a fraud. She put her hand in another man's hand. She put her faith in another man's God. She put her money in another man's bank account. That other man is a fraud. She's another man's cup of coffee, sitting by another man's bed. She got to deal with the problems of another man's head. She's worshiping another man's God. She put her money in another man's chimney. Lord, that other man is a fraud. Big faith in another man's religion. Worshiping another man's God. Yeah, she put her money in another man's chimney. That other man is a fraud. She put her stockings on another man's chair. She put stockings everywhere. She put her lips on another man's cheek.
another man's drinking and way another man's smoke. She got to deal with another man's dirty fingernails, another man's heavy duty problems, another man coming in late from the party, another man's hang-ups, hang-ups so often. Put her faith in another man's religion, hopes in another man's dreams. She put her money where the sun don't shine, another man's multi-billion dollar investment schemes. Who is that other man? Who is that other man? Who is that other man? The other man is me. Who is that other man? Who is that other man? Who is that other man? The other man is me.
We are in the midst of a famine, and it lays its withered hand on every one of us. Yet many choose not to see it, although it's as plain as the sun in the sky. We've been lied to so long we detect only plenty, and by doing so give truth to establishment lies. For we've been fed the line that our democracy is strong, something to be celebrated, that it is the yardstick by which all democracies should be judged, and at its heart is Parliament, the Parliament, a parliament that perfectly reflects the common will, or so they would have you believe. But this claim is no more substantial than a dream. In truth, democracy totters on brittle legs, gone to face and ravenous, and the election which just befell us never more clearly laid bare their fiction. For we labour under a level of democratic iniquity that, were it attached to some tinpot regime on some far-flung corner of the map, would provide good fare for idle chatter and self-congratulation, rather them than us, eh? And so we once again find ourselves under the yoke of a Conservative Party that acquired more than half the lot of parliamentary seats, the mandate to rule. Surely such a result is a reflection of votes cast, a majority decision, democracy in action. But never was reality further from the truth. In point of fact, the vast majority, some 64% of the British public, cast their vote elsewhere, for all the good it did. And so the cycle begins again, and democracy hasn't moved a solitary foot. Our first-past-the-post system is only fit, at best, for a two-party state. But so rusted through and misshapen is it, that it simply delivers the establishment result, time after time after time. A Labour or any other party victory is merely an anomaly, a ruffling of the Conservative status quo. Yet the moment we question our electoral mechanisms, stripping them of all artifice, all distraction, the more quickly we realise their failings. And whilst democracy cannot be simply switched off, it can be shackled and bias built into the system. We would like to think each vote was equal, that each vote cast was uniform in value, but this is not so. To win a parliamentary seat for the SNP required 26,000 votes, or 34,000 for Conservative, and 40,000 for Labour. But if you cast your lot in with either the Green Party or UKIP, then over 1 million, or almost 4 million respective votes would be required to return a single MP. This will not do. Such a system does not deliver any meaningful form of democracy, democracy light at best. If representation reflected votes cast in the last election, then Parliament would be a much changed place, and more democratic. Instead of a solitary MP apiece, UKIP would have 82, and the Green Party 24. The Liberals are plump and healthy 51 MPs, and, interestingly, the SNP only 31, revealing the truth of their landslide victory, a victory in which only 50% of Scottish voters placed an X beside their candidates. The other 50% didn't want them, but got them ad nauseam. And we need to talk about money. Money and its ability to further skew the results of an unrepresentative system. Money and its corrosive effects on democracy. For where the money goes, the election follows. And the money flows to the establishment's political wing, the Conservatives. They can, almost without fail, lay their hands on many millions of pounds more of election funds through the support of business than any other party. and as such can generally buy the election. It's akin to being at an auction where the wealthiest bidder wins, every time. Simply extending to the political realm, a social and financial system in which rank, wealth and privilege continue to determine outcomes. We need to create an electoral practices that curtail such spending, with Parliament both setting and allocating election funds and media exposure, whilst moving to ensure unfair methods and backdoor electioneering by third parties is stamped out. There is nothing more ridiculous than hearing the Conservative Party crow about their election win when they simply bought it. It's no more worthy of celebration than purchasing a pack of potatoes is. But change will come. The blinkers have begun to fall and truth will out. And though democracy has been locked in some forgotten room of some forgotten house, the space it leaves is a mighty force, a sentient void, simply waiting for us to reclaim it.
And the stock market has its best week since July.
But now you've learned to accept it. Millions crawling toes in a world of illusion. Break your back on the factory line. Suits, push pants and demand some more. You can't give them the satisfaction. You never quit. You press on and on. Chunky superficial dreams. New age slaves, freedom is a sin. Money chunky superficial dreams. Take you down. The dilemma of being seen to lose helps them to their daily genocide. Retirement waits like a long lost friend. After a lifetime of banging your head, you work my troll beside you one by one. Something keeps you going. Something wrong. Something wrong. Something wrong. Slaves, freedom is a sin. Money, junk is superficial dreams. New age slaves, freedom is a sin. Money, junk is superficial dreams. You've been dreaming too long.
That was The Exiles and Money Junkie.
It is a tragic irony of Australian existence that a country A continent the size of Europe can be so much the same shore to shining shore. Among its 23 million peoples, there is seemingly very little difference one person from the other. We speak the same language, deploying the same accents, follow the same sports, watch the same TV channels. We are Rupert Murdoch's playthings. Hallie's one of ours. Local boy makes good. The most monopolised media networks in the Western world make sure that the political debate doesn't drift too far to the left. We may have a national broadcaster, modelled on the BBC, but that too is very much under threat today. In this mix is a long-standing national expectation that this is indeed a lucky country. Aside from a comparatively buoyant economy sustained by the boom in mining and mineral prices, we have not known civil war, famine, political cataclysm, invasion or relentlessly bad cricket scores. Stuck in the South Pacific, a first world country surrounded by various foreign lands, we seem blessed. Despite the turmoils to the north over the years, the mass slaughter of at least 500,000 communists next door in Indonesia in 1965-66, the Vietnam War savagery, the long-term genocide of the people of East Timor, Australia could go about its capitalistic business as though it's marooned in fairyland. The wee scattering of islands to the east in the South Pacific may be sinking under rising climate change-driven seas, but all we see in our shoreline are sandy beaches and an excuse for a suntan. This sense of containment has been fueled by over 200 years by the overbearing dominance of Anglo-Celtic peeps as the rootstock of the country's existence. The keen attempt to wipe out the indigenous population may not have worked as it was intended, but for most of its existence, the country has had a white Australia policy. Supposedly, we know who we are. As the Labor Party immigration minister quipped in the 1940s, two wongs don't make a white. This sameness is sustained by xenophobia. Fear of the yellow peril was utilised as a backbone of Australia's foreign policy for decades. The nation ignored Asia and preferred to mix it with an old blighty. If anything, Asia was seen as a series of landmasses that only served as potential stepping stones for godless communism. The domino effect dominated national consciousness. To defend the land from the occupation of the Reds, Vietnamese, Chinese, Indonesian or Malay, Australia made a pact with the United States, and the ongoing alliance has ensured that there's hardly a bang-up shooting war worth fighting that Australia hasn't got a hand in. Our government cheer-squatted any and every US invasion. It garages its bases and defers to its foreign policy interests. When the country sought to top up its population in the post-war years, it begrudgingly allowed non-speaking Europeans into the place and later engineered the demographics and the cover of the nationalist ideology of multiculturalism. And lo, folks started migrating here from all over. The shift didn't have anything to do with opening up the country to huddled masses yearning to be free, but it was a gesture to those markets, like Asia, the local bourgeoisie sought to draw their profits from. Walking through the central business district of any Australian state capital today, you'd think the place was some melting pot of all the world's peoples. In the street would be people of Chinese, Arab, Slavic, Maori, Italian, or whatever descent. You'd presume that Fortress Australia, the chronic isolation of the country, had been drowned in a melting pot of mixed ethnicity. You'd be very much mistaken. Australia is much more racist today than it has been for over 50 years. A conscious tag team exercise sponsored by both the country's Labor Party and the local Tories has brought back a xenophobia under sponsorship of the War on Terror. And in an irony of political manipulation, there is a new push to base the national identity on its Anglo-Celtic past rather than its multicultural present. And if you were wondering what ever happened to the old South Africa, with its apartheid habits and sharply divisive racism, I tell you, it crossed the Indian Ocean and now resides in Australia. This country may not have a crudely xenophobic racist outfit like UKIP rising in the polls. We don't need it. The duopoly of the two main political parties, the ALP and the LNP, are doing a fine job of racist bashing and blaming by themselves. If you check out Australia's standing on human rights, according to the United Nations, in the way the country incarcerates asylum seekers, manufactures and treats terror suspects, or suppresses the Aboriginal population, we're up there among some of the most autocratic countries on the planet. Way to go, Australia. Aussie, Aussie, Aussie. Oi, oi, oi. We're not just good at sport. Making Kylie Minogue's or servicing Dame Edna Everidge with anecdotes, Australia has engineered a very nasty attack on civil liberties at a time when the true depth of austerity and economic downturn has not hit here yet. How smart is that? We have a boss class that thinks ahead. How lucky can any one country be?
Let's start with a definition. A definition of war. War is when your government decides who you fear and insists on it with lords. How about if we all disagree, having a true democracy? The powers that be keep us hungry. Work it out for yourself, you'll see. How about a war on poverty? Choose your enemy. Division by class, and the boot of oligarchy, and the muscle and the force. What they're battling for is equality, not a force, the opposite of peace. Understand their conflict of a policy, capital, giant supremacy, do it economically. Honey, choose your enemy.
Country. As inequality continues to fester and grow, it is high time purposeful and effective measures to challenge this situation were introduced. The Scottish Service Tax is the Scottish Socialist Party's flagship local government policy, and it is designed to do exactly that. I'm Callum Martin of Edinburgh South and Midlothian SSP, here today to give a bit of an explanation as to what the Scottish Service Tax is and why we need it. Now, the Scottish Service Tax is designed to serve as a replacement for the council tax. The council tax is a fundamentally flawed policy, and its abolition and replacement are long overdue. Betraying its origins as a replacement for and successor to the infamous poll tax, it is inherently regressive in its nature. Under the council tax, the poorest will always shoulder a much heavier burden than the richest. This is because, whilst the gap between the highest earning 10% of the population and the lowest earning 10% of the population has widened greatly in recent years to a ratio of around 15 to 1 across the UK, the council tax differential remains fixed at around 3 to 1. This means that even with the current range of council tax bandings, the percentage of income paid by the richest is but a fraction of the percentage paid by the poorest. It has been calculated, for example, that whilst the council tax claims 5.2% of the total income for the poorest 20% of the UK population, the richest 20% contribute a mere 1.7% of their income. The consequences of this are brutal. Many pensioners in Scotland could now pay over a quarter of their income in council tax. And the issue is further compounded by the rising cost of living. In 2005, the Citizens Advice Bureau revealed that 25% of the debt cases they assisted with that year involved council tax debt, rising to around 33% by 2009. Given that current Scottish debt laws allow poll tax debt and council tax debt to be collected up to 20 years after they were first incurred, the fundamental of the iniquity of the council tax will only continue to worsen as years go by. It is utterly wrong that in 21st century Scotland, working class communities and low-income households should still be paying the price for the regressive and reactionary politics of the Conservative governments of last century. The answer, therefore, is clear. The council tax must go, and Holyrood has the power to abolish it. The fact is, though, that in scrapping the council tax, Holyrood could do more than simply reduce how regressive our local tax is. By introducing the Scottish service tax as the new model of local taxation for Scotland, Holyrood could proactively use the principles of progressive taxation and the powers devolved since 1999 to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor. And the Scottish service tax was designed for this exact purpose in 2003 by eminent economist Jeff Whitman Mike Danson. A bill to introduce the Scottish service tax was introduced to the Parliament by SSP MSPs, but the Labour Liberal Democrat coalition of the day voted it down in favour of retaining the council tax. Now, despite the rejection of a policy by the Labour Party, support for the Scottish service tax remains widespread amongst quite a number of economists, and the Scottish Socialist Party has continued to champion this policy for the opportunity it represents. Now, the provisions of the Scottish service tax are both simple and effective. Crucially, unlike with the council tax, with the Scottish service tax, the bill is based upon ability to pay and taxes incomes through six bandings which apply at higher rates as incomes rise. Now, these bandings are carefully calibrated across income ranges at a fair and balanced rate. For example, the first £10,000 of income would go tax-free. Income between £10,000 and £30,000 would be taxed at 4.5%. Income between £30,000 and £40,000 would be taxed at 15%. Income between £40,000 and £50,000 will be taxed at 18%. Income between £50,000 and £90,000 will be taxed at 21%. And income above £90,000 will be taxed at 23%. Now, for example, this means that with an income of £25,000 a year, the first £10,000 will be under Band 1, so you would pay no tax on that. The following £15,000 would be under Band 2, giving you a total bill of around £675 each year. Now, this bill is around a third of what might be expected under current council tax rates. So under these provisions, approximately 77% of households in Scotland would find their local tax bills fall. Now, fundamentally, on top of fundamentally redistributing wealth, the policy would also be far better able than the current council tax to raise the necessary money for funding local services. For the tax year 2012 to 2013, the Scottish service tax held the potential to raise an estimated £4.1 billion, more than enough to avoid any further cuts to vital local services. A second question, often asked as well, is worth asking is how would this money be collected? Well, Holyrood already has the power to access and utilise existing government infrastructure for income taxation, and so there would be no need for additional bureaucracy in order to introduce the Scottish service tax. There'd be no need to set up a whole new tax system. And this was a point confirmed by the Local Government Finance Review Committee's report of 2006. Another third question that is sometimes asked of the Scottish service tax is how effective could it be at tackling tax avoidance? That's a good question. I think the answer is very clear. A report commissioned by the PCS in 2010, combined with work done by the SSP, can provide some very effective answers to this. Income tax avoidance as a whole is able to continue for two primary reasons, according to work done by the SSP and this PCS report. Firstly, the legal loopholes frequently navigated by chartered accountants, and secondly, because of increasing understaffing at HMRC tax inspection offices. A government that wanted to avoid income tax avoidance could very effectively close these loopholes and could very easily give HMRC the necessary staff, training and equipment to ensure that the public purse is not being denied what it is due. These two actions could and would rule out the possibility of it being possible to avoid the Scottish service tax. For more information on the Scottish service tax in printed format, there are a number of options. The current issue of the Scottish Socialist Voice contains an article on the subject. Last week as well, on the 22nd of June, we saw the new Local Tax Commission for Scotland close their submission date. The SSP submission on the Scottish Service Tax will be made publicly available in due course and contains more information on many of these points, and indeed many other points too. And I believe there indeed is many other articles on the Scottish Service Tax set to be available in coming weeks and months. So then, to summarise, of all the proposals being put forward for how to reform or replace the council tax, only the Scottish Service Tax was designed with the fundamental purpose of redistributing wealth from the rich to the poorest. It will come as no surprise, therefore, that the Scottish Service Tax is by far the most effective proposal for doing so. The case then is clear. With local government a devolved matter, Holyrood has all the powers needed to scrap the council tax and introduce this new redistributive policy. It's time then to axe the council tax and introduce the Scottish Service Tax. I've been Callum Martin, thanks for listening.
Alright ladies, any news on Tillilagosh?
Chance I could get your number. First edition. Any chance we could do some kissing?
Hey boy, you're all so sensitive, but I'm afraid I'm just not interested. Hey boy, you're all so sensitive, but I'm just not interested. Hey boy,
I just want
you're
a girlfriend.
So
thanks for listening. You just heard the Just Jones and Hey Boy, You're Oh So Sensitive, and the Mighty The Faction, who play the left field stage in Glastonbury on the 27th of June with Choose Your Enemy. Socialist Voices will be taking a rest until the end of July. Thanks for listening, and look out for Scottish Socialist news on www.scottishsocialistparty.org, on Twitter on @the_SSP_, and seek us out on Facebook. This is Neil Scott reminding you all to go out and educate, seek education, agitate and organise.